This is the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, all about the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL, featuring insider and outsider perspectives. Enjoy the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Now here are your hosts, Jess Root and Seth Cox.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. As always, I'm your host, Jess Root, from CardsWire.com, the NFL Wire site from the USA Today NFL Wire that covers the Arizona Cardinals. This is episode 312, a bonus episode as we continue our opponent preview series. Our first episode of the series, episode 311, cover the Cardinals' first three opponents of the season, the Tennessee Titans, the Minnesota Vikings, and Jacksonville Jaguars. This edition will cover the NFC West, whom they play six games against, the LA Rams, Seattle Seahawks, and San Francisco 49ers. We will start with the Cardinals' first NFC West opponent, which is the LA Rams, whom they play in week four and then again in week 14. To returning for the second year in a row is Cam DeSilva, our managing editor over at theramswire.com, our NFL Wire site from our USA Today family. And Cam, welcome on the show again. It seems like, honestly, it feels like it was just a little while ago that we had you on a year ago to preview the Rams season. And this is a season to be excited about the Rams, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't seem like long ago, like you said, but good to be back.
So what we'll do, kind of want to go through the timeline of the last roughly year, talk about the season, how that went, the highs and the lows, kind of go through the offseason, the losses and the impact, the additions and their impact, the draft. And we're obviously, I don't think I want to predict games, but how you think the two teams will match up, since they're division rivals, what we view as the sort of the outlook for both teams heading into this season. So let's take it back to the 2020 season. The Rams had an interesting year, to say the least, because sometimes they looked like the best team in football, and the other times were questioned and just oddly bad, especially on offense. Jared Goff was good and bad sometimes. He seemed to take a step back. What was your take on the season last year, how things went, and ultimately how it ended?
Yeah, it was really the story of two sides of the ball, where defense, like you mentioned, was the number one defense in the NFL. And then the offense kind of just lagged behind, trying not to make mistakes to sink this team. But it really came down to Jared Goff just turning the ball over too often, not making the right reads, and not taking shots downfield when Sean McVay did give him the opportunity to. It was kind of a conservative offense, a lot of checkdowns and short passes, and allowing Cooper Kupp and Robert Woods to do a little something after the catch. I think they both were top 10 in yards after the catch, so that kind of gives you an idea of what the offense looked like. It was a lot of just short passes over the middle, and then see what they can do after the catch. It wasn't a lot of throwing beyond the sticks and taking shots downfield. So it was disappointing in that regard, because we saw in 2018 when they went to the Super Bowl that this offense has the potential to be one of the best in the NFL, and just so explosive. You have so many good receivers, a decent offensive line. It just didn't come together. And I think a lot of that was Jared Goff. And obviously we saw that this offseason with the Rams trading him for Stafford. But it was just too many mistakes. They did win a playoff game, surprisingly, a game that was started by John Walford before he got hurt. Jared Goff came in with a messed up thumb, led them to a win over the Seahawks, and then they got kind of crushed by the Packers in the divisional round. But their losses to the 49ers in the second half of the year hurt. Their loss to the Jets was downright embarrassing, and they had no business losing that game at home to Sam Darnold and the Jets. And that really, I wouldn't say that canceled their chances of winning the division, but it definitely hurt him. And obviously it didn't end up making that big of a difference, because they did beat the Seahawks in the first round and advanced. But just losses like that really crushed them and didn't do them any favors as far as being a whole cohesive team that can win offensively and defensively.
So if you look at how the offense changed, was that more of Goff's decision-making, or was that McVay almost losing trust in in his ability to make plays down the field?
A little bit of both. I think you saw a little bit of loss of trust from McVay with his play calling in the red zone. He was conservative. He called a lot of screens. He called runs on third and long. He just really didn't trust Goff not to make a mistake. And he even said at one point, I think it was after the game against the Giants, that they were in the red zone. Obviously the Giants weren't a very good team. And he said he just wanted to take the points and take the field goal. He didn't want to take a chance of turning the ball over and doing something bad. And that's really
an indictment. Which is a weird thing
on.
To hear from one of those ballsy offensive-minded coaches that loves
exactly.
to take
yep.
chances.
Yep. You would think him in that situation, put the gas pedal down and score some points against the Giants. And he settled for the field goal, and he said it afterwards. So I think it was a loss of confidence in Goff. And then Goff, on the other hand, his decision-making was just not good, especially under pressure. We saw that when the Dolphins really crushed the Rams and they sent the house at him and a lot of just single man coverage. And then the rest of the guys blitzing and coming off the edge, and it fooled him. So it was a little bit of both, but the offense, really, I would say Sean McVay worked with what he had, and he didn't have much with the way that Goff was playing.
So before the one thing I want to talk about, because it's the first thing that kind of happened the off season, and that was the move that obviously the trade couldn't technically happen till March, but mm-hmm. the news of the reported trade, the agreement with the Lions to acquire Matthew Stafford. There's a couple of ways that people look at this, and I want to get your take on this, because obviously it was Jared Goff and a pair of first-round picks, which feels steep, to say the mm-hmm. least, which means you can look at it one of two ways. If you look at Jared Goff as an asset, maybe for the Lions, therefore giving up Goff and two first-round picks is huge. Like that's saying, hey, you think Stafford is the guy to put this team over the top for reals. Or it was really, he wasn't an asset in this case, that he mm-hmm. was baggage. And so mm-hmm. the second first round pick they had to give up was not for Stafford. It was so that the Lions would be willing to take Goff. Which way do you think that actually went? And had you know, they've been able to deal with, like, cut ties with Jared Goff and just trade for Stafford, would it have taken two first-round picks to do it?
That's a good question. That's something I've asked myself a lot since that trade went down, because I would have been very curious to know what they could have gotten for Goff, if anything, if they decided to trade him flat out for picks and not involved in another trade for a quarterback. Would they have gotten anything in return? Would they have had to trade a draft pick the way that I don't remember who traded
Osweiler
him. Was
trade.
It the Broncos? Yeah. Was it the Broncos that traded him or the Texans? I think
it was
the
Texans.
To the Browns.
Yeah.
Yep. So would it have been that, where you're begging a team to take on his contract? The fact that Brad Holmes was their college scouting director and now he's the GM of the Lions, I think maybe he sees some potential still in Goff. I think he might see him as somewhat of an asset, and they're going to start him obviously this year. They didn't take Justin Fields or a quarterback early. So I think the Lions do view him as somewhat of an asset, but two first rounders plus a third rounder plus Jared Goff is a lot to give
That's
up a for
lot.
A veteran quarterback. And I think it'll work out for the Rams. I think they're going to have a good season where Stafford is going to succeed and all of that. But it's a steep price to pay. And I really wish I knew what the Rams would have gotten
because the Cardinals play the Lions this year. I'm going to ask Jeff Risden that question as well, just to kind of gauge, because like, did the Lions really need two first round picks from the Rams to get Matthew? really?
Right.
I mean, especially if you look at the trades in the past, we look at the Cardinals got Carson Palmer in 2013 for a ham sandwich. And it wasn't literally a ham mm-hmm. sandwich, but it was basically a seventh round pick the
yep.
next year. And it was nothing. It was nothing. And you could look at a lot of parallels in the two of their careers, but Matthew Stafford, how much do you see him being an upgrade over Jared Goff? I will say I am so sadly positive as a Cardinals fan myself, because I've grown, born and raised here in Arizona, watched, paid attention to the Cardinals since 1989, 1990, to see the Rams go from this team that they have and add Matthew Stafford, I think personally, the Rams should be the favorites in the NFC this year. And that hurts me to say.
Yeah, I do think it's a big upgrade. There are obviously questions, some questions about his durability. He's had some injuries over the years. And then the fact that he's only made the playoffs three times and he went 0-3 in those games. So there's some questions about those aspects. But just from a statistical, a schematic, a football IQ level, he's a big upgrade over Goff. I think Goff has the tools and the traits and the arm to be a good quarterback in the NFL, but there's times where he doesn't recognize blitzes. He doesn't recognize what the defense is doing. He doesn't get the ball out quickly enough. He doesn't make the right reads when he's under pressure, where he doesn't see the receiver that he's supposed to target quickly out of the backfield. Things like that, where Matthew Stafford, Sean McVay has said it all offseason, Matthew Stafford has seen all kinds of defenses. He's been in all kinds of offenses. There's nothing that he hasn't seen or done in the NFL. And Andrew Whitworth said it too. It's something that you can only gain through experience. It's not something that Jared Goff can necessarily have at this point in his career, even though, I mean, he's what, 5 years into the NFL right now. So he should not be making these rookie type mistakes.
Especially the season that he had in 2018 in that first year.
Right.
So
yep.
You look at,
I mean, he was in the MVP conversation.
Right. Yeah. Right. That's the thing that blows my mind is that was he, like, everyone talked about McVay keeping in, like, getting up to the line of scrimmage so that he was still in his ears. Did that really make that much of a difference? Because you figure that's, was that it? Or as personnel changed, that it was just the wrong mix, the offensive line issues that they had after that, because their offensive line was so healthy that year. You hate to see a young player do that. Like, as a division rival, you're like, hey, we don't mind. But just as a football fan, you hate to see players decline so quickly. And we saw it from him. We saw it from Carson Wentz. We've seen it from a number of players that show some promise early on. And they just sort of, they don't keep up that success.
Coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web, we continue the conversation with Cam DeSilva from Rams Wire, talking about the Rams coaching changes, additions and subtractions in free agency, the draft class, and their outlook for the 2021 season. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red.
We'll set Stafford to the side first. What are some of the, there were a couple of coaching losses. So you lose Brandon Staley. And he becomes the coach of the Chargers. You lose Shane Waldron. You have a new defensive coordinator. What is the impact of the coaching changes going to have? The losses and then the changes into Raheem Morris in particular. What are they going to be the impact of the coaching staff?
I think they're pretty significant. You go from Brandon Staley, who I would say should have been the coordinator of the year last year, number one defense, first year as a defensive coordinator. Just the scheme that he drew up for that Rams defense was outstanding, with getting Aaron Donald as many one-on-one matchups as he could, putting Jalen Ramsey in positions where he's shadowing DK Metcalf 1 week. He's playing the star slot role against the Giants the next week, where Golden Tate is in the slot and he's taking him away. Just the things that he drew up for that defense were really, really good. And like you mentioned, they lost Waldron. He's the new OC in Seattle. They also lost Aubrey Pleasant, their cornerbacks coach. Their offensive line coach stepped away, Aaron Cromer. I'm not sure exactly what happened with that situation, but they have a new offensive line coach. So there's some pretty significant changes along the coaching staff, which is nothing new for Sean McVay. I mean, he's churned through coaches and assistants so rapidly in his first 4 years in the NFL, whether it's Zach Taylor, Matt LaFleur, all these guys going on to head coaching gigs. But they're pretty significant. I think Raheem Morris is a good fit. He has experience with McVay. They're friendly. They're both young, bright-minded guys who are pretty innovative and creative. And I know there's some concern about Raheem Morris's Falcons blowing so many leads last year, but with Aaron Donald and Jalen Ramsey in that in the same defense, I think it's going to be hard for him to screw it up. He just can't.
Let's hope.
I mean, he said it himself. He's like, the only thing I don't want to do with Aaron Donald and Jalen Ramsey is screw them up. Just let them be them. Just let them be the stars of the defense. So I think he's gonna fit in nicely with what the Rams have already built there, with the defensive personnel that they have and the playmakers. Darius Williams is a good player, so I think that's going to be a decently smooth transition. But we'll wait and see.
Do you see a potential scheme change? Because Raheem Morris has basically run even fronts his entire career, mm-hmm. and I know going from Wade Phillips, like the Cardinals run a Wade Phillips defense as well with Vance Joseph, going to Brandon Staley as well. Do you see a fundamental change in that front? Obviously, we see across the league that when you're a nickel, it's pretty much an even front all the time. But there are some mm-hmm. assignment differences. There are some philosophical type of differences. Do you see that being a problem? Do you see the defense being maybe not as dominant to start the season because of the scheme / terminology changes?
I don't think there's going to be a huge change. McVay and Morris kind of talked about it, where it's going to be mostly the same defense as what Staley was doing. It's still going to be a 3-4 odd front, where you have three down linemen and then for the most part two edge rushers. But the Rams, like you said, they run so much nickel like so many other teams, where there's so many 4-3 and even front aspects to the defense where it doesn't make a huge difference what you call it. But the defense did lose a lot of players. Troy Hill, John Johnson, Morgan Fox was a key player. So there are going to be changes personnel-wise and scheme-wise. I just don't think the changes that Morris is going to implement are going to be that dramatic, where things are going to change significantly for the guy, the key players like Donald and Ramsey and Darius Williams.
You mentioned some of the losses defensively. Who are the more impactful losses? I think Troy Hill's going to be, both Hill and Johnson, I think, are going to be mm-hmm. impactful losses because of the play that they've had. Michael Brockers, it was a different type of loss. That's interesting. The story that goes with that, he ends up in Detroit with Jared Goff. But who are the, you've already mentioned some, what are going to be the biggest losses in the offseason?
Yep. So John Johnson and Troy Hill both going to the Browns, going to that secondary. I think those are going to be big losses, especially Johnson. The Rams do have good safety depth with Taylor Rapp and Jordan Fuller and Terrell Burgess and Nick Scott. So they do have good safeties, and they drafted Robert Rochelle, and they have David Long to step in at cornerback. But those are going to be transitions that they have to kind of figure out in training camp and see who's going to start, who's going to be the primary backups. And then on offense, they lost Josh Reynolds at wide receiver, Gerald Everett at tight end, Austin Blythe at center. Those were three starters on offense. They already planned to move Austin Corbett to center to replace Blythe. And then they have Van Jefferson, DeSean Jackson, Tutu Atwell to help replace Josh Reynolds at wide receiver. So that's not going to be a huge loss, I would say. And then at tight end, Gerald Everett, he was a key player for them. Although he didn't put up big numbers, he was really that versatile pass-catching tight end.
Oddly disappointing, yeah. I think, would be that considering how he came into the league.
Yeah, being a tight end, Sean McVay's first pick as a head coach, with Sean McVay being a former tight ends coach, he kind of had the hype of like a Jordan Reed, where he's going to be this really great pass catching tight end, and it just didn't come together for him.
He was fine. That's basically
exactly fine is a perfect way to he was fine. He was exactly what you would expect from a number two tight end, really, just not what Rams fans hoped he would be.
Now, in free agency, we've already talked Stafford. Who are the other impactful additions to the team that are expected to contribute?
I can count them on one finger. DeSean Jackson. They did nothing in free agency, really. It was DeSean Jackson. They didn't really add anyone of note in free agency. They re-signed Leonard Floyd, and it was just a whole bunch of losses. So you bring in DeSean Jackson. He reunites with Sean McVay finally after he said it a couple of years ago. He wanted to play for him. They played together in Washington. So he's going to step in as probably the number 3-4 receiver. I don't know. I mean, it depends if he stays healthy. It depends what his role is going to be, but I don't see him playing a huge role, to be honest, with how much talent they do have at wide receiver.
Yeah, I mean, between Robert Woods and Cooper Kupp, and then Van Jefferson, who you know is the son of the Cardinals' new receivers coach.
Yep,
he wishes it well, but he, like he said, he wants to kick his tail. Those twice a year.
Twice a year.
He wants to kick Van's tail on Sundays. And the draft, obviously, what was it, like three draft picks that you guys ended up having?
I think they had nine. They started with six or seven.
No. Seattle ended up with like three picks.
Yeah, Seattle had three.
So they had no first round picks and had a whole bunch towards the end for the Rams. But the first Tutu Atwell, interesting selection because the dude is tiny. Tiny. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How much impact do you see him making this year? I mean, he's fast, but he's like, my co-host on the podcast normally, who has a draft podcast of his own, they look at Atwell and say he's tiny, one, and he's not as fast as you would hope he is. He's not even like JJ Nelson that the Cardinals had a few years ago, because he was a 4'2 guy. Mm-hmm. And a little bit taller, but weighed in at about 155. 157. I think he might have technically been listed at 160.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't stay, like, he was a nice player, but really struggled to stay healthy at that frame. And what, mm-hmm. Tutu even weighed in at one point at like 140 something?
Something like that, yeah. In one of his weigh-ins. I think he posted a video on Twitter of him hitting like 159 or something, he's small. Either way, he's small.
What impact do you think he'll have this year?
I don't think it's going to be a big one. Just with how much talent they have at receiver, with Woods, Kupp, Jefferson, Jackson, those four guys, I think, will probably get most of the snaps at wide receiver. I see Atwell as more of a gadget player, which I don't know if you want to spend a second-round pick on a gadget player who's not going to really be a true wide receiver. He's going to take handoffs. He's going to run deep. He's going to catch screen passes and try to make something happen after the catch. But I didn't love the pick when it happened. I didn't think they needed a wide receiver, especially after signing Jackson, who I know is injury prone and I know it's a 1-year deal, but it just seemed like such a luxury pick. And I honestly think they wanted Dwayne Eskridge, who went to Seattle, who was a little bit bigger, still a fast guy, still a good returner. But Sean McVay will try to find ways to get Atwell involved, whether it's on punt returns, kick returns, handoffs, just creative ways. I just don't know what his impact is going to be. McVay didn't really have a great role for Tavon Austin when he was there in 2017. So it's hard to say what his role is going to be, honestly. I don't think it's going to be a big one, though.
What do you see? Are there any other draft picks who will have any sort of significant role or even complementary role as we hit the 2021 season?
Yeah, Ernest Jones, their linebacker in the third round, I think he has a chance to be a day one starter. Again, didn't love the pick because he's not one of those rangy, athletic, ball-hawking, zone coverage linebackers that we see so often in today's NFL. He's more of a downhill run defender who is a smart player but is limited athletically. But with their situation at linebacker, I think he has a chance to contribute from day one just because they don't have really – a surefire starter at that position. I mean, any of the guys, I can count four or five guys who have a chance to start, but they could also be cut. So it's a huge range of who's going to start, who's even going to be on the roster. So I think Ernest Jones is going to carve out a role at linebacker. Bobby Brown is an intriguing defensive lineman who can play pretty much any spot up front. But the guy really to watch is Jacob Harris. If out of UCF, he played receiver at UCF, but he's transitioning to tight end in the NFL. Still has a lot to learn. He's undersized. He's only like 215 pounds, but the guy is an athletic freak. I mean, he's more athletic than even Kyle Pitts, I would say. He's 6'5", runs a 4.39. He has a huge frame, big catch radius. He just needs to learn how to play tight end better and really gain experience because he was a soccer player in high school. And really only played two seasons of college football as a receiver. So he has a lot to learn, but his skill set is so intriguing. And the way that he's performed in minicamp and OTAs, he's kind of impressing a lot of the coaches. So could see him make an impact.
And lastly, as we look ahead to the two matchups that the Cardinals and the Rams will have, not predictions, What do you see the outlook for the Rams coming into this year? Personally, I think they should be the favorites in the NFC West. I think that division could actually go a number of ways. I think the Rams are the best constructed team. And honestly, I understand why people have the Cardinals with the longest odds to win it, but they could do as well. What do you look for? What are you looking forward to in terms of matchups when the Cardinals and Rams play in week 4 and week 14? Obviously, the Rams have had the better of the Cardinals since McVay took over. They've won the last 8 matchups, so they haven't beaten the Rams since 2015. They haven't beaten Stafford since 2015. They did get a tie in 2019, but they haven't beaten Stafford since 2015. How do you see those matchups fitting this year?
I think it starts with Jalen Ramsey and DeAndre Hopkins, and that's going to be kind of the headliner for each of those matchups. But it's going to come down to Kyler Murray with what he can do against this defense, because it's going to be a good defense again this year. The linebackers may not be the most equipped to stop him, however, because they're not the most athletic and rangy group. So if he can stay healthy, I know he wasn't for that last game last year, but if he can stay healthy and find ways to use his legs against this defense, I think that's a good course of attack for him. The offensive line, I think, is improved in Arizona. Correct me if I'm wrong. I like that Rodney Hudson trade for them and what he brings to that offensive line. So the Rams in the trenches without Brockers, I think that's, I wouldn't say a significant loss, but it's someone they're going to have to replace. And same with Morgan Fox with that rotation up front. But I do like the way that the Rams match up with the Cardinals. Obviously, like you said, they've beat them, 8 times in a row and scored something like 30-plus points each time. So it hasn't been particularly close, but it is a matchup that I do like the Rams in.
All right. Prediction, what are your predictions for the Rams this year? How many wins do you think they'll get? And do you think that they will be a Super Bowl contender this year?
I do. Yep, I do. I think a 10-7 season, that sounds weird to say, but a 10-7 season, it would be disappointing for them. I think their range should be around 11 to 14 wins legitimately. 14 being a really, really good season, because they do have a tough schedule. They play the Bucs, they play the Packers, they play their 3 division teams twice each. So it's not necessarily an easy schedule, but I think 13, 14 wins is legitimately possible for them. And I do think they'll be a Super Bowl contender. It's going to come down to Matthew Stafford's fit and how quickly he gets acclimated to that offense, whether the defense can overcome the losses of John Johnson and Troy Hill and Brandon Staley. But they're equipped to go pretty deep into the playoffs.
All right. Well, Cam, thank you so much for your time. Again, that's Cam DeSilva from theramswire.com. You're probably familiar with the site if you're listening to this show as it is. As we do a rundown every offseason, every week we go through the NFC West, and so we kind of pick and choose some of the stories from his site. But I appreciate your time as always.
Coming up next on the Rise Up Secret Podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web, we move on to the Cardinals' next divisional opponent, the San Francisco 49ers, whom they play in Week 5 and Week 9. That's another opponent preview coming up next on Rise Up C-Red. We're back on the Rise Up C-Red Podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Let's move on to the San Francisco 49ers. And to give us more insight about the Cardinals' next division opponent is the managing editor over at NinersWire.com, Kyle Madsen, on the show for the second year in a row.
Kyle, welcome back again to the show. I always love having you on. Always enjoy talking to you, whether it's here, whether it's on Slack, Twitter, whatever. I'm glad to have you on the show again.
Yeah, honestly, I don't want to say I'm offended that I only get asked on once a year, but I enjoy this podcast a lot. So thanks for having me.
So let's take it back to the 2020 season, which obviously was a disappointment for the 49ers, of course, coming off their Super Bowl year and then injury after injury after injury. One, were there any highs for that team last year? And obviously tell us, what were the biggest disappointments and the lows for the team in 2020?
All right, I'll start with the highs because there were four of them. Brandon Ayuk, their first-round rookie that they traded up to number 25 to get, is really good. He is a I think their best receiver already, even better than Deebo Samuel, just from a pure receiver standpoint. He had 750-ish yards in 12 games. He was really excellent, and I think gives them a receiving threat that they haven't really had in a while. So that was definitely a high. Jeff Wilson was good against the Patriots. That was good, I guess. But the lows, the injury problems were really bad. Of course, Fred Warner was an All Pro. Excellent again. That was a good thing. But the lows, I mean, the injuries across the board. George Kittle, Jimmy Garoppolo. I mentioned Brandon Ayuk missed 4 games. Deebo Samuel missed a bunch of time. Richard Sherman missed, I think, 13 games. Jason Verrett, another high, played a career high in snaps. He played 13 games and he was excellent. Probably their best corner. But they, when you're as beat up as they are, or as they were last year, and you're running out Nick Mullins and CJ Beathard at quarterback, you're not going to win a lot of games. And they were and winning
games against the Cardinals with CJ Beathard. That was embarrassing.
Oh boy. But again, you want to talk about injuries? Like Kyler was beat up in that one. Yes. So, but I also think there was an element of the defense playing for Robert Saleh, knowing that it was Robert Saleh's last couple games, but that's neither here nor there. They weren't good enough with the injuries they had. Nick Bosa goes down in week 2. Jimmy Garoppolo goes down in week 2. Raheem Mostert went down in week 2. It was just a brutal, brutal stretch for them. And then Dee Ford and Richard Sherman had gone down in week 1 and missed significant time. So that's like, and George Kittle got hurt against the Cardinals in week 1. I mean, that's what did I name? Like 7 guys, and that's like 7 of their best 12 to 15 players.
Like any team that goes through that, and that's the hard part. I mean, they make that Super Bowl run. They have a lead in the fourth quarter,
mm-hmm.
and they run it back with a lot of guys that they know they're going to be good, but you can't count on injuries. Well, and honestly, the offseason didn't start well for you guys either. Granted, mm-hmm. Like Justin School's not a big name, but it's you hate to start on that note after what happened last year.
Yeah, they already have. You mentioned Justin School, who is a reserve offensive lineman competing for a swing tackle job. He goes down with a torn ACL. Tavarius Moore, who is probably going to start at strong safety for them and maybe be their long-term free safety, tears his Achilles. He's done for the year. Jeff Wilson Jr. Here's how Jeff Wilson Jr. got hurt. He tore his meniscus. He's out 4 to 6 months. He got hurt standing up in the locker room. He had got done weightlifting, was sitting down in the locker room, talking to some guys, stood up, and his knee locked up. And it turns out he tore his meniscus. Like, and like you said, Wilson was probably going to be their number 3 running back this year. School was a reserve offensive lineman who wasn't even guaranteed a roster spot. Moore is the only one of those guys who was probably going to be a starter, and even that wasn't a guarantee. So, like you said, though, the omen is not great for what they've been through in the last 12 months. On the calendar. The good news is Nick Bosa's recovery from his torn ACL in week 2 is going really well. He spent the offseason in Florida with Joey Bosa, his brother, and a trainer that they work with, Dee Ford, who it initially sounded like wasn't going to be healthy for the start of the season or maybe any of the season. He's had back surgery again. I think it's his third one since college. There's now optimism that he's going to be ready for training camp. So if he's healthy and Nick Bosa is at full strength, well, now the Niners defense cooking with gas again. And then they just got to figure out what's going on under center. But if they're healthy, they're good. But that health thing is a sizable question mark going into the year.
We hit free agency, notable departures, notable additions, and are most of the additions just returning to health? I know that you guys brought back Jason Verrett. Smart move if he can stack 2 healthy years together, because mm-hmm. question has never been talent. It's always been about durability with him. Right. Richard Sherman, he's not signed with anyone. Apparently the door hasn't been closed, but it felt like at the end of last year, it was definitely goodbye. Who are the key departures? Who are the notable additions in free agency?
I think Richard Sherman's probably the biggest departure. Kerry Hyder, their leading
sneaky
sack getter,
pass rusher.
Yeah, just a really like right on passer, like just a good little player. He's like Jay Crowder for pass rushers. That might be selling Crowder a little short. I'm trying to relate it to a Phoenix sports team. But no, he's just a quality good.
Benson Mayo reserve. A couple years ago in their terrible year in 2018.
Yeah, just like he probably shouldn't be starting on a good team, but he was forced to for the 49ers last year, led them in sacks. He's now in Seattle, but they retained Trent Williams, which was a big deal. They retained Kyle Juszczyk, which was another little bit of a question mark. Kaywan Williams, their nickel corner, not a super well-known name, but he's a really good player who I
analytically
didn't think was,
always comes up in all those football book, those touchdown wire rankings.
Yeah, he's a really, really good slot corner. And I thought he was for sure going to go sign with the Jets and Robert Saleh for a bunch of money, but he didn't. He's back in San Francisco. Jaquaski Tartu was our starting strong safety for most of last year. He's back. They did a really nice job retaining a lot of their free agents without losing anybody, where if you look at the guys they lost, it's not like, oh man, how are they going to replace that guy? A lot of just replaceable. Even Richard Sherman, he was hurt for most of last year. You lose that leadership, but I think he's now officially in the twilight of his career, where I think his level of effectiveness was going to start dissipating pretty rapidly.
Coaching staff, obviously the big move is that Robert Saleh leaves. He becomes the head coach of the Jets, DeMeco Ryans. What do you expect? Do you expect any changes that were going to be notable? Cardinals went through this exact same thing back in 2015 when Todd Bowles also got hired away by the Jets and James Betcher took over. Betcher ended up having statistically two or three years of very good defenses statistically, but it was different. He didn't change a lot of the scheme, but in some ways the effectiveness, even though statistically was good, was not as good effectively.
James Betcher, who's now with the 49ers defensive coaching staff, oddly enough.
That's right.
One addition I failed to mention, Samson Ebukam from the Rams, who the 49ers, I think, are hoping can have a Shaq Barrett-type impact when Barrett went from the Broncos to the Bucks and got recast as a 4-3 defensive end instead of the 3-4 outside linebacker. He really thrived, and I think the Niners are hoping Ebukam will do a similar thing. So as far as the coaching staff goes, DeMeco Ryans is such a huge question mark because DeMeco Ryans was playing in the NFL in 2015. Like he was in the NFL not that long ago and only started coaching in 2017, but everybody raves about him and you'd expect that from the players. And the 49ers really went out of their way to surround him with assistant coaches who have either defensive coordinator experience or long position coach experience. So that's going to be, I think, the biggest thing is how he handles that transition from a position coach to a defensive coordinator, where now he needs to see the whole defense. We'll see. It's they haven't made any huge blunders from a coaching standpoint, so I have some faith that Ryan's will be fine. And if they didn't think he was going to be, they would have gone elsewhere. But that's the biggest change. I don't think we'll see a significant difference in their defense. I think he's going to run pretty much the same scheme. He said he wants to be more aggressive, which may mean more blitzing, but which means that Robert Saleh did not do a lot of. He really tried to pick and choose his spots. So Ryan's a former linebacker, may want to send more guys more often, but outside of that, I don't think we're going to see a pretty any kind of significant difference from the Niners defense, at least schematically. And then offensively, one very minor addition that I think is important is Rich Scangarello, who was their quarterbacks coach up until he became the Broncos offensive coordinator in 2019. He spent 2020 with the Eagles as like a special assistant to the coaching staff. And now he's back as the quarterbacks coach. And I think that he is, I think he's really good at his job and a really good QB coach. And I think that's going to be important for Trey Lance's development.
Which leads us to the draft. They make the big move, presumably. But the talk was the entire time. Did they have a quarterback in mind? were they still wondering? Because obviously we knew it was going to be Trevor Lawrence. We knew it was going to be Zach Wilson. The question mark was at three. Trey Lance is the addition. Was he always the pick, or did they actually not know up until like a couple of weeks before? And I'm sure they probably, what's the real story there?
I don't know if we'll ever get the real story. I have a theory on it that when they were picking at 12, Kyle Shanahan was looking at the quarterbacks and fell in love with Mac Jones because he thought that they were going to be at 12 and they were going to be able to pick Jones, which it turns out if they had stayed at 12, they would have been able to. So I think that we're sitting there and telling people like, oh yeah, if Mac Jones gets to us, it's going to be Mac Jones. Da, 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 da. Then I think they traded up when Shanahan started diving into the other quarterbacks and realized, oh man, Trey Lance might have something. I don't think it was ever Justin Fields. I don't know why. I can't explain it to you. I
especially after what, the two actually knew each other and had worked together.
Yeah. Yeah. It just all the reporting and everything that Shanahan and Lynch have said, it just seems like Justin Fields was never an option. Like the report came out that on the flight home from Columbus after Justin Fields' pro day, Shanahan was drawing up stuff for Trey Lance. So I don't think Justin Fields is ever in the mix. So I think that they traded up to three to ensure that if they wanted Trey Lance, they could get him. But they needed, at the end of March when they made the trade, I think they made the trade with Lance in mind, but were comfortable taking Jones in the event that something showed up in Lance's tape that they really didn't like. Or, I mean, but it was 17 games. I'm sure they had seen all the tape a million times. Or they heard something from a coach that they didn't like. Or Lance started working with John Beck at a quarterback academy. John Beck and Kyle Shanahan know each other very well. And maybe they saw something, or John Beck saw something that he didn't like with Lance, or got a bad report from him, or whatever it was. In that case, it would have been comfortable taking Jones at three, but that obviously didn't play out that way, and they didn't find anything wrong with Lance, and he was the player they thought he was going to be when they went into a further dive, and he ended up being the pick. So I think that was maybe confirmed for Lynch and Shanahan, you know, a week before or 2 weeks before, whatever it was. But I think the reason all the Mac Jones stuff came out is because that was going to be the pick at 12. And that would have been the pick. That would have been the pick if, like I said, they found something with Lance they didn't like.
That makes a lot of sense. And in many ways, for John Lynch to do that was almost trying to get Kyle Shanahan out of his own way, because Mac Jones is exactly the type of quarterback that Shanahan has loved. And lived and died with, apparently.
He got asked. Shanahan got asked before the draft, like, people say Kirk Cousins is your archetype quarterback. Is that true? And it's a great question because nobody's ever asked him that point blank. And he basically said, just because I had Kirk Cousins, people think like Cousins started like 16, 32, 40 games for him. He started four games for him.
That's true.
Yeah. And I know that Shanahan was on the staff that drafted Cousins the same year they drafted RG3. And there was that whole drama with Dan Snyder, but Shanahan said, like, just because I like Kirk Cousins and wanted him in free agency doesn't mean he's my archetype quarterback. Like, you don't get a lot of opportunities to draft Patrick Mahomes or a star like that. So you just kind of roll with guys you think you can win with. And I think I can win with Kirk Cousins, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's my archetype. And then he said, I want if you're drawing it up, you get the biggest, fastest, strongest quarterback who's the best in the pocket. And when you looked at the quarterbacks available, and I wrote about this at Niners Wire, it's like, man, that's Justin Fields or Trey Lance. Correct. Like it's not Mac Jones. And I had pre-written, because all the reporting came out, talking to people who talk to people. I don't have sources, but I know people who do.
Yes.
And they said, like, it's Jones. Like, it's Mac Jones. That's what people in the building thought. So I pre-wrote a bunch of stuff about how, like, hey, that's obviously BS. Like, you traded three first round picks to go up and get not the biggest, fastest, strongest guy, but it turns out that they kind of did. So
and that works out.
Coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web, we continue our conversation with Kyle Madsen from Niners Wire about the rest of the 49ers draft class and then their outlook for the 2021 season. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red.
Obviously, he is the prize of the draft, and basically the entire draft will be judged on the performance of Lance. But they do pick up some other talented players. Aaron Banks in the second round, guard out of Notre Dame. Trey Sermon, running back, Ohio State in round three. You also pick up Michigan cornerback Amber Thomas in round three. After that, it's day three picks. Who do you see making a significant impact of the draft class? Who do you think is going to have a significant impact on the season? And who are the players you think will make more complementary impacts? Obviously, in the draft, you always end up with guys that are just guys and don't really impact at all. But which guys do you expect to make contributions this year?
So I think Trey Sermon is going to make the biggest impact, like statistically. With Jeff Wilson Jr.'s injury, I thought Sermon already had a good shot at being the RB2, and now I think he's definitely slotted into that spot. He's like Deebo Samuel, but as a running back. They're built the same way. They have a similar running style, and I think giving him 10 to 15 carries a game is gonna work. I think he's going to be a good player right away. And the 49ers traded – they hadn't drafted a running back since taking Joe Williams in the fourth round of 2017, and he never played a snap for them. They traded 2 fourth-round picks to trade into the third round to draft Sermon. So they must really like what he brings to the table, and I think that's going to bear out over the course of the year. Aaron Banks, though, you mentioned that, the guard from Notre Dame, is going to be – I don't want to dive into deep-dive 49ers offensive line talk, but in short, their interior offensive line has not been very good. And if Banks is good and he starts and is an effective player – it will do wonders for their offensive line and fix maybe the biggest weakness in their offense. And of course, all this is not mentioning Trey Lance, who I'm just going to kind of leave out because who knows where he's at.
That. Yeah, that's the whole thing is,
yeah,
at what point does he take right over?
It could be week one. It could be, you know, you mentioned the 49ers and Cardinals play week 5 and week 9. They might see two different quarterbacks. You know, like it could come.
Aside from the issue of Garoppolo's history of durability is the question about Jimmy Garoppolo. There's mm-hmm. always that issue. But do you think that Shanahan will make the move with a healthy Garoppolo on the field?
Not if they're winning. I don't think they're going to be so week 6 is their bye. And I've kind of circled that as the, all right, that's 5 games to see where the offense is at. They don't play until that Sunday night. So it would be debuting Sunday night against the Colts. And then they travel the following week to Chicago. It's just like, man, that's a good like spot to drop him in. You got 5 games of Garoppolo, but if they're 5-0, going into their bye week, you can't justify benching the starting quarterback. Now, if they're 3-2 and the offense is kind of struggling a little bit, and then I think they make the change. But as long as Garoppolo is effective and they're winning, I don't think they're going to force any kind of change in year one. The issue comes in where Lance only played one game in 2020. So if you're making him sit this entire year, and then you're just going to plug him in
without playing at all.
Yeah, he's going to go into 2022 like 28 months removed. Is that right? 28 months removed from his last football game, which is insane. So I think he'll play this year. I think he'll start at some point, mainly because you mentioned it. Like, Peter King put the over under for Garoppolo at 10 games, and he said he's taking the over. I have no evidence that Jimmy Garoppolo can stay healthy for more than 10 games.
Right. That's the thing. So that's, even when he was backing up Tom Brady, he got hurt in this 4-game stint.
Yeah. He's been healthy through the 5 games he played for the 49ers at the end of 2017. He tore his ACL week 3, 2018, was healthy in 2019. They go to the Super Bowl. And then 2020, he gets an ankle injury in week
Never
2.
Recovers.
And then again, in when he tried to come back against the Seahawks, I think in week 8. So, I don't know. Ultimately, the draft class of Trey Lance is awesome. None of the other picks matter.
Correct.
But those picks are going to matter because I don't think Lance is going to start. Trey Sermon, like I said, is going to be the guy. Aaron Banks is somebody I'm watching really closely. And then if I'm picking one of the kind of later round guys, you mentioned Ambry Thomas. He's a really interesting player for them because he's going to be like their first cornerback off the bench. Their cornerback depth is not good. They also drafted Diamador Lenore from Oregon. I think they envision him being K1's replacement. Williams re-signed on a 1-year deal, and he's more of a slot type corner from Oregon. So I think Ambry Thomas is the other guy that if you know, we're sitting here this time next year looking at the rookie class and saying, oh man, that was a good player. Thomas, I think, is the guy that I'm looking at.
All right. So looking ahead to the 2021 season, we think personally, I think the Rams, even though I have some questions on defense, probably are the favorite. And I think for me, it might actually be the favorite for the entire NFC, but the entire division is completely up for grabs. You got the 49ers who are healthier and we're coming off a Super Bowl, should have been in the mix. So I think any of these four teams will be in the mix for the division. What are sort of your hopes and expectations? What do you think their floor and ceiling could be this coming year?
So I think their floor is right about where it was last year, like 6-11, you know, that kind of range where they're in the playoff hunt towards the end, but they need some things to go their way. The biggest thing they did this offseason in drafting Lance is they improved their backup quarterback situation. I've never seen Lance play a snap, but I think he's going to be better than Nick Mullins and CJ. The bar's not super high. So I think they've helped themselves in that area, but we've seen if this team gets hurt, which they've dealt with injuries, even their Super Bowl year, they were without their two starting tackles and Kyle Juszczyk for a time. And Richard Sherman with some injury stuff. So that's where their floor is. I think, I don't think they're going to be picking in the top five or anything like that. Their ceiling is a Super Bowl team again, but that's if they're healthy. That's if D Ford comes back and is an effective player. Samson Ebukam makes the jump that they expect him to make. Jason Verrett can stay healthy. It means that Garoppolo is not only healthy, but maybe takes a little bit of a step up from where he was in 2019. They have the pieces to be really, really good, but I mean, I could go through again, like their top 10 players and like 8 of them, you're going to circle with pretty sizable injury question marks. And that's just kind of a reality in the NFL. So I agree with you on the Rams. I think Jared Goff is super holding that offense back. And now Sean McVay has a quarterback who's going to just let it rip.
And I'm happy for Steph because I love him as a quarterback. I wanted him in Arizona for years.
Yeah.
But the Rams.
Yeah. I thought so. I put it out in the ether, and I still believe this. If Matthew Stafford had come to the 49ers, I think you were looking at like a Matt Ryan 2016 type season where he's for 5,000 yards and 40 touchdowns, and he's just incredible. I then have to say that same thing for him and a Sean McVay offense. Right. Like
honestly, they're similar. That Vance Joseph, our defensive coordinator, has said as such. Mm-hmm. They're those two offenses, even though they talk differently, they're schemed the same.
Right. Right. And I mean, there's all this talk that Robert Woods is like super underrated, but he's not. Like he's he's excellent and everybody knows it. And I just think their vertical passing game is going to make them just so much more difficult to defend. And then when you have Jalen Ramsey and Aaron Donald playing defense, like that makes things really, really hard for an offense. So they're going to be good. I mean, I think the jury's out on the Cardinals and Seahawks in a way.
A lot of things have to go well for the Cardinals that I think if everything goes the way they have it in their mind, that's a team that can as well compete for a Super Bowl. Everything going well, Seahawks, it's going to come down to one, are they going to hold Russ back? Is he going to be as effective? It's a lot of things like that offseason stuff. It's going to be weird to see how that happens.
Yeah. I'm never going to rule out the Seahawks. Like the Seahawks are going to win 10 or 11 games, and that's just kind of how it's going to go. How they do it, I don't know. But yeah, I'm never going to rule out the Seahawks for being in the discussion. So I have a theory, and this is a theory as somebody who follows the Cardinals very passively compared to you and anybody listening to this podcast for sure. But I'm not certain Cliff Kingsbury is a very good coach.
This is kind of the they've done what they've needed to. Like, if you look at what he was hired to do, he's done that. Mm-hmm. They've improved each year. He took a historically bad offense and made it pretty good.
Right.
In-game decisions, sometimes, like, for a super aggressive coach, he goes super conservative at some critical moments late in game. And that's kind of the thing. I think this is the year that's kind of make or break for his reputation, because they need to be a playoff team, or they probably need to look elsewhere to take Kyler Murray to the next level, because I think Murray is good enough to be great in any system.
Absolutely.
You look at what Baker Mayfield did when they took him out of a spread system. He was under center a lot, and that Browns team in the AFC, talent-wise, is on par with Buffalo and Kansas City this year.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I say that about Cliff Kingsbury, is like, it's not talent. The Cardinals are loaded.
We're banking on a lot of old guys.
Yeah. But I don't know. It's just the Cardinals have just a lot of really quality players. My biggest question when I say like the jury's out with the Cardinals, it's not like, I think Kyler's awesome. DeAndre Hopkins is obviously really good, and their rushing attack is really good. I don't know if Cliff Kingsbury's the guy.
Yep, that's what we're going to find. One final question that would be, what do you think are the 49ers a playoff team if Trey Lance is starting more games than he's not?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I think what he brings as a runner just unlocks a version of Kyle Shanahan's offense that we haven't really seen. I think he's a more advanced passer than Robert Griffin III. So I don't think it's going to be identical to what we saw from Washington in 2012, but they were an excellent rushing team. And I think we're going to see that from San Francisco whenever Trey Lance
already
does
runs
play.
The ball really well. They're really
hard. Yeah. And now, so the theory is, the way this goes is, you have those outside zone runs, right? With Raheem Mostert, it's what he's really good at. Well, now you have to account for the quarterback and play action and boot actions. And he throws the ball down the field with
Kittle and Ayuk and Sam
with more regularity than Jimmy Garoppolo does. He has an arm. So I think they can still be a playoff team if Trey Lance is starting more games than he's not.
All right. And with that, we will wrap up this segment. Kyle, thank you for coming on. But thanks, Kyle, for that time. Again, that's Kyle Madsen from NinersWire.com.
Coming up next on the Rise Up C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web, we move on to one final opponent preview in this edition of the show, wrapping things up with the Seattle Seahawks, whom the Cardinals will face in week 11 and week 18. That's coming up next on Rise Up C-Red. We're back on the Rise Up C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Let's move on to the Seattle Seahawks. The Cardinals face them in week 11 and will close the season in week 18. To preview the Seahawks, just as we did a year ago, we bring back Cole Musgrove, a contributor from SeahawksWire.com, our NFL wire site dedicated to our NFC West rival. Cole, welcome again to the show.
Absolutely. Well, hey, I'm happy to be here. You know, it's funny, the last time we were here doing this last year, you know, we mentioned, you brought up to me, you know, is this finally going to be the season the Seahawks and the Cardinals end their weird, only the road team wins? And it turned out that both teams were able to defend home field for the first time in what feels like forever.
It was that year. Nonetheless, Seattle got the best of the Cardinals overall. They end up winning the division, but the Rams avenge themselves and beat them in the first round of the playoffs. Tell us about the 2020 season. Go back. What were the highs and the lows? Because as we know, the Cardinals, the Rams, and the Seahawks at some point during the season all looked like the best team in the NFC. And none of them ended up looking that way at the end of the year. So what were the highs and the lows from last season?
Well, I think certainly the highs, you know, came right off the bat. I mean, Seahawks got to their first 5-0 start in franchise history, beating their previous best mark of 4-0 in the 2013 year. Russell Wilson was on fire to start the first half. Had some pretty electric wins, like the Sunday night win over the Vikings. Unfortunately, the lows were the offensive meltdown late in the season. Russ got cooked. He started becoming Mr. Turnover. The offense became aimless. And while the Seahawks did finish, 12-4 for only, with 12 wins for the, fourth time in franchise history, as you mentioned, they didn't do anything with it. They got snuffed out by the Rams. They just can't seem to fight that boogeyman off.
So, obviously, kind of a disappointing end, especially after such a good start. What was it? What happened to the offense? What was it? Was it a case of Russ trying to do too much after the defense really gave them little to work with early on? Was there something schematical that changed? Or is there something in Russ's protections or decision-making that changed after that 5-0 start?
I think it was just pretty much kind of a combination of all of the above. I mean, it didn't help that we had all the running backs hurt again for a significant stretch of the season. I mean, thankfully we got Carson back late, but him being out certainly made the offense look more like the 2017 version, where it was just Russell Wilson carrying the load the entire time, and it was just dangerously unbalanced. And, he started doing too much, and then Coach Carroll started to pull back, play more peat ball, more run-centered. And then the offense just kind of became a little stale and predictable. I mean, we had several players like DK Metcalf come out and say teams knew what they were going to do at the end. So the Seahawks just kind of reached their ceiling with Schottenheimer as offensive coordinator, and just fell apart. And as far as protection goes, I mean, the Seahawks offensive line, that's been the running joke for how many years now, that they've struggled. But really, they were top 10 in pass block win percentage. But yet they were 31st in giving up, pressures. So at some point, the offensive line had an issue, but Russ also had an issue getting rid of the ball, especially down the stretch.
The change in the offensive coordinator, so they go from Schottenheimer to Shane Waldron, another of Sean McVay's followers, kind of the coaching tree that Sean McVay has. And now it kind of looks like, are the Seahawks going to run a Rams offense, giving the entire NFC West kind of the same base? The 49ers, the Rams, and now the Seahawks, are they going to be running that Shanahan-style zone run scheme? Is that the Cardinals are going to have the same offense to prepare for six times a year, it appears?
Yeah, well, if you can't beat them, I guess sign them as your offensive coordinator. So, the Rams have certainly, it doesn't matter who's quarterback, Jared Goff, Case Keenum, Nick Foles, over the years, they've known how to beat the Seahawks defense, Legion of Boom or not. And hiring someone from them, who knows our weaknesses, that can only help us, I think. And, it's been no secret that the Rams offense has been consistently one of the better in the NFL. So to kind of apply that to a quarterback like Russell Wilson, some players like DK Metcalf, Tyler Lockett, Chris Carson, having that sort of thing, I think it's going to be great for the Seahawks. Just bring some fresh blood into the perspective.
Before we talk about some of the changes in free agency, we have to talk about the offseason seeming turmoil with Russell Wilson, who publicly aired some displeasure about how the offense was run, the number of hits he's taken. Pete Carroll reportedly unhappy that he aired that dirty laundry publicly. Russ not requesting a trade, but giving the Seahawks a list of teams he'd be willing to be traded to. It's kind of, to me, was he wasn't asking for a divorce, but he was lining up the girlfriends in case he did.
It was, I'm not going to cheat on my wife, but if you were to give me a hall pass.
These are, oh my gosh. How serious was that? How close were they to having a real divorce in terms of football sense, where they actually had to cut ties?
From my perspective, I think a lot of it was, there was something there. I really do believe that Russ was frustrated. And I think a lot of that comes from, as he says, they had a horrible ending to the season. And I think there was plenty of frustration going around the whole building. But I also think a lot of it was right after the Super Bowl. We're still hungry for the NFL. We're hungry for any kind of story. So I think, you see that leak here from Adam Schefter about the teams he'd want to go to. Some of his comments on Dan Patrick. I think a lot of that still kind of the media took and run with it. I still think that it's salvageable. And as we could see, the Seahawks The Seahawks took a lot of moves this offseason to rectify the situation. I mean, they signed, you know, Gerald Everett from the Rams, bringing that with Shane Waldron, who Russell Wilson was involved with the hiring process with. They re-signed Chris Carson to make him happy. They drafted a speedy receiver in Dwayne Eskridge for him, re-signed Tyler Lockett. So the Seahawks, and then they traded for Gabe Jackson. So the Seahawks, I think they got the message that, you know, Russ, you know, probably wasn't ready to just jet and leave, but he kind of sent him a little warning shot, which he's done in the past. I mean, there's been times during contract negotiations where he's gone to Yankee spring training, or he's given them the deadline, and there was the midst of he would want to be traded to the Giants of all places. So a little bit of drama here and there popping up periodically is kind of par for the course with Russell Wilson at this point.
Which is interesting, because the most interesting guy that says the least interesting things actually said something, and it was something, because he normally says nothing of substance at all. You mentioned of the free agency additions. Were there any potentially impact losses? I know initially it looked like Carlos Dunlap was going to be an impact loss, but then they brought him back. Who are notable losses that the Seahawks no longer have?
Well, the one for me that I'm personally sad to see is David Moore. He left for the Panthers, and I thought he was a great number three receiver. Him and Russ had an interesting connection where it always seemed like on fourth down or some crazy, you know, point in the game, 83 was getting called, and which, you know, maybe because the safeties were busy with DK and Lockett elsewhere. But I'm going to miss him. I think he's a good pickup for the Panthers. And then one player who isn't technically gone yet, but it's still getting late in the game, is KJ Wright. He still remains unsigned. The door still seems to be open for him to return, and I certainly would love to see him back, because he's an all-time great Seahawk, great team guy, best friends with Bobby Wagner. But if he were to leave, that would be pretty impactful for the defense.
How impactful is the loss of Jaron Reed?
You know, that's just kind of a weird situation. I think it is going to be pretty impactful down the road. Yeah, because one of the dirty secrets of the Seahawks defense, the pass defense was so atrocious, they were getting all the press. But when teams committed to the run against the Seahawks, they saw a little resistance. Teams like Minnesota, the Rams, the Giants, and their crazy upset last season, they were able to find success on the ground. So losing an impactful player like Jaron Reed, you know, that the Seahawks got a hole. They got to figure that out.
You mentioned some of the additions. Who do you think are going to be, at least in free agency, who are the most impactful in your opinion? Obviously, bring back Carlos Dunlap. You add Gabe Jackson via trade. Any other significant contributors or complementary contributors that are coming in that are new through free agency?
Well, I mentioned it previously, but Gerald Everett, the tight end from the Rams.
Yes.
You know, he's been killing us for years. So it's good to get him off the Rams, but then someone who knows Waldron's style of offense, someone who's athletic, can kind of bolster up the tight end position for the Seahawks, which I think is pretty fine. But adding someone like this, that's going to be much more of an upgrade than adding, you know, Greg Olsen last year.
Right. And one of the biggest issues that the Seahawks have had is simply their durability at tight end position. Will Disley's great when healthy, and he has a hard time avoiding those major injuries. Greg Olsen had issues. But Gerald Everett is an interesting guy, because he was McVay's first pick. And as promising as he is, we'll see if the Seahawks can turn that promise into production, because he's been a productive but slightly disappointing version of a tight end that they'd hoped that he'd be. But the potential is still there.
The potential is definitely there, and then not to mention he's getting a significant quarterback upgrade.
Yes, that is true. That is definitely true.
Coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web, we continue the conversation with Seahawks Wire's Cole Musgrove, talking about the Seattle Seahawks, moving on to talk about the draft, their draft picks, and the outlook for their 2021 season. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red.
Looking into the draft, so they had ultimately 3 picks. You mentioned Dwayne Eskridge. What role do you think is he going to have this year? Will he? My co-host normally, we were doing our rankings, our divisional rankings for the NFC West positions, players, etc. And my co-host Seth, he thinks that Eskridge will probably end up being that number three. Do you anticipate him being pretty much the number three option over the course of the season?
Absolutely. I mean, at this point, you have two. You don't have a 1 and a 2 in Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf. You have 1A and 1B. Lockett is Russell Wilson's security blanket. You see him go to him
so good
time and time so again. Good. Oh, especially that Sunday night game so against good. The Cardinals.
Ridiculous.
I mean, unstoppable. And then DK Metcalf just keeps growing into being clearly one of the best receivers in the game.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of room at the top for Eskridge to move up to a 1 or a 2 this year, certainly. But having his elite speed just kind of coming underneath, being that number 3 option, that's just going to help open things up for the Seahawks offense.
The other draft picks, where do they fit in?
Well, Trey Brown's got a spot right off the bat, the cornerback from Oklahoma. Corner has certainly been a major weakness for the Seahawks. I mean, we had a little bit of luck with DJ Reed from the 49ers last year, kind of blossoming into a nice star. But, you know, with the loss of Shaquille Griffin and, you know, Trey Flowers not really being an NFL starting caliber cornerback, he's got an opportunity to make a name for himself right there.
That's all right. No, I was going to ask about who. I don't remember who the third pick was.
The third one is an offensive tackle with the best offensive tackle name ever, Stone Forsythe.
That's right. Does he play this
year?
I
think so. I'm really excited about him. You know, certainly some question marks, obviously, along the offensive line. So I think he's got a real opportunity as well.
All right, let's move ahead to looking forward to this season. We've got an NFC West division where, honestly, I think any of the four teams, if things go right, all four of them could win the division. Personally, I have the Rams as the favorite, and even though they've got some questions defensively, I consider them the favorite of the NFC because I think Matthew Stafford upgrades them significantly offensively, even though they have some questions defensively. That said,
I agree.
What are your hopes for the Seahawks? What are your expectations for Seattle entering this next season? What do you see their floor and their ceiling being?
Well, I certainly agree with you about the Rams certainly being the prohibitive favorite. I mean, they had the best defense in the NFL last year. They were still a 10-win team. They beat the Seahawks. They moved to the playoffs, had a pretty competitive game, and that was with a quarterback with a broken hand. And even with the hand, I mean, it's still Jared Goff. So having, I can say that it's
that's fine. It's not a Lions podcast. We dislike Jared. We still have to face Jared Goff in Detroit now.
Well, I'm happy to see him gone because that guy could somehow always. I never thought he was a good quarterback. We always seem to beat us. But yeah, with Matt Stafford, I think he is just a monumental upgrade, especially how complimentary McVay has been. As far as the Seahawks go, the ceiling. I mean, even with the offensive meltdown last year, the Seahawks were still a 12-4 team, and it was still a pretty competitive game for the most part with the Rams in the playoffs because the defense, they figured it out. Adding Carlos Dunlap, that was just a game changer for the defensive line. They showed life. The secondary did just enough. And really, in a lot of those games late in the season, the defense kept the Seahawks in it because Russ and the offense were faltering. So I guess the biggest thing I think the Seahawks need to do is keep that offensive consistency. And this wasn't just a last year issue. Three out of the last four seasons, the Seahawks offense has just melted down for whatever reason, whether it be injuries or poor play or just running into buzzsaw of opponents. It's what's been keeping the Seahawks back. So if they were able to keep that, if Russ is able to maintain that MVP style play, or at least just not turn into Mr. Turnover, then I think the Seahawks are looking, you know, potential another 12-13 win season. As far as the floor goes, yeah. I mean, this division's tough. I agree with you that I think all four teams not only believe they have a shot at winning the division, I think there's a reason to believe that all four teams have a shot at running at the Super Bowl. I mean, that's just how
like, this is a case where all four teams, it's a case where everything goes right. Like the Cardinals, I think.
Absolutely.
They have questions about the players they added, but I think overall, I think as you look at the position groups, I think the Cardinals might have the fewest number of questions in terms of roster other than individual players that they added who are old and injury prone or has missed time. But But any one of these teams could win the division. If all goes well, all of these teams could be Super Bowl contenders. And I think it's going to come down to how they perform against each other. Someone's got to win four games in the division to win that division.
Absolutely. And it's going to be, I think the road goes through the Rams at this point. I know Seahawks are defending division champions, but I mean, they ate our lunch in the playoffs. They're the top dog right now.
I see 9 to 13 wins is potential for Seattle, where if things don't go well, they could win as few as 9 games, and still nine games is a floor.
Exactly.
That's a really high floor.
Look, at the end of the day, Russell Wilson's still the quarterback. Yeah. And when you have a bona fide top five superstar Hall of Fame caliber quarterback like Russell Wilson, your floor is still never that low. I mean, Matt Ryan's the only franchise caliber quarterback who's somehow can't escape 4 or 5 win seasons. Even when the Seahawks missed the playoffs, they were still 9-7 back in 2017. So, if things fall apart, the defense collapses, we get horrible injuries, I still see 9-8 as kind of the floor. But if things go well, we could be competing for top 1 or 2 seed.
Absolutely. And thank you, Cole, for your time on this segment. This will wrap up this segment about the Seattle Seahawks. Make sure to check out Cole's and the rest of the writers at SeahawksWire.com, our NFL wire site for the Seattle Seahawks. During the offseason, of course, you should be familiar with it. We do a rundown of each NFC West team's week of news. You can catch Cole's work there. That'll wrap up this edition of the Rise Up C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We'll be back with 2 episodes next week, bonus episodes until our training camp preview. Our next episode at the beginning of next week will feature the Cardinals' opponents in weeks 6 and 7, the Cleveland Browns and the Houston Texans. So catch us next week. Thanks for listening, and go Cardinals.
Thanks for listening to the latest edition of the Rise Up C-Red podcast. Listen to previous episodes and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Audioboom, or many other podcast platforms so shows are delivered directly to your mobile device. Please give the show a 5-star rating and always support the sponsors who support the show. We'll be back soon for the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Rise up, Red Sea, be Red Sea Red, and of course, Rise Up, Sea Red.